I play no cricket, but very few members do. Don't ask. Fewer than 1,400 students matriculate to Haverford, yet there are over 50 buildings, most made of stone, strewn over 200 manicured acres, so glorious that it is technically classified as an arboretum. The Lockwoods have been woven into the rich tapestry that is Haverford College since its conception. Windsor I and II both graduated from Haverford, both remained active, both served as chairman of the Board of Trustees. All of my male relatives attended. Women were not admitted until the 1970s. Until, now that I think of it, Uncle Aldrich was the first to break ranks by choosing New York University in the 70s. I was the second when I elected to go to Duke University in North Carolina. I loved and continue to love Haverford, but for me, it was simply too close to home, too much a known entity for what my 18-year-old self craved. Professor Ian Cornwell's office in Roberts Hall faces Founders Green and, beyond that, Founders Hall, where the Vermeer and Picasso had been taking up temporary residence when they were stolen. I wonder about that, about Cornwell's office view of the building where he'd been tied up whilst the two robbers went to work. Does he think about it often, or, after a while, does the view simply become the view? Ian Cornwell tries too hard to look professorial, unruly hair, unkempt beard, tweed jacket, mustard-hued corduroy pants. His office contains half-crumbling stacks of papers on the shelves and floor. In lieu of a proper desk, Cornwell has a large square table that seats 12 so that he can hold student seminars in an intimate setting. "So glad you could visit," Cornwell says to me. He has me sit in front of brochures related to the political science department. I look up at him. His face is eager, ready to pitch me to support financially some sort of study or class. Kabir has no doubt hinted that I would be interested in funding so as to expedite this appointment. Now that I'm here, I nip this hint in the bud. I'm here about the stolen paintings. His smile drops from his face like a cartoon anvil. "I was under the impression you're interested. I might be later," I say, cutting him off. "But right now, I have some questions about the art heist. You were the night watchman on duty." He doesn't like my abruptness. Few people do. "It was a long time ago." "Yes," I reply. "I'm well versed with how time works, thank you." "I don't see." "You know, of course, that one of the two paintings has been found, correct?" "I read that in the news." "Terrific. So there's no need to play catch-up. I've combed through the FBI file on the heist extensively. As you might imagine, I have a personal interest in this, too." Cornwell blinks as though dazed, so I continue. "You were the only security guard on duty that night. According to your testimony, two men disguised as police officers knocked on the door to Founders Hall. They claimed there was a disturbance that needed to be investigated, and so you buzzed them in. Once inside, they subdued you. They took you to the basement level, duct-taped your eyes and mouth, and handcuffed you to the radiator. They rummaged through your pockets, pulled out your wallet, checked your ID, and told you that they now know where you live and how to find you. A threat, I assume. Have I got all this correct?" Ian Cornwell slumps into a chair across the table. "It was a traumatic experience." I wait. "I'd rather not talk about it." "Professor Cornwell."
"Yes?"
"My family lost two priceless masterpieces on your watch."
"You're blaming me?"
"I will if you refuse to cooperate."
"I'm not refusing anything, Mr. Lockwood."
"Terrific.
But I also won't be bullied."
I give him a moment or two, so as to save face. He will capitulate. They always do. A few seconds later, he offers up a contrite, "I don't know anything that will help. I told the police everything 100 times over." I continue undaunted. You estimated that one of the two men was 5'9"-ish with a medium build. The other was slightly over 6 feet tall and heavier set. Both were white men, and you believe that they were wearing fake mustaches.
It was dark, he adds.
Your point being?
His eyes go left.
None of this was exact, the height, the weight. I mean, they could be accurate, but it all happened so fast.
And you were young, I add, and scared.
Ian Cornwell grabs hold of these arguments as a drowning man does a life preserver.
Yes, exactly.
You were just an intern hoping to make a few extra dollars.
It was part of my financial aid requirement, yes.
Your training was minimal.
Not to pass the buck, Cornwell says. But the school should have provided your family with better security.
True enough, though many things about the case and the investigation bothered me. The painting had only been scheduled to be on loan for a short time, and the dates were fixed only a few weeks in advance. We had indeed added security cameras, but this was before the days of storing digital video in clouds, and so the recordings were kept on a hard drive on the second floor behind the president's office. How did the thieves know where to find the hard drive, I ask? His eyes close.
Please don't.
Pardon?
You don't think the FBI asked me all these questions 1,000 times back then? They interrogated me for hours, denied me legal counsel even.
They thought you were in on it.
I don't know. But they sure acted like it. So I'll tell you what I told them. I don't know. I was duct taped and cuffed in the basement. I had no idea what they'd done. I spent 8 hours down there until someone came looking to replace me in the morning.
I know this, of course. Ian Cornwell had been cleared for a lot of reasons, the biggest being that he was only a 22-year-old research intern with no record. He simply didn't have the brains or experience to pull off this heist. Still, the FBI kept surveillance on him. I, too, had Kabir go through his bank records to see whether a late windfall came into his life. I found none. He seems clean. And yet. I want you to take a look at these photographs. I slide the 4 photographs across the table toward him. The first 2 are blown up from the famous photograph of the Jane Street 6. One is of Rye Strauss. The other is Arlo Sugarman. The next 2 are the same photographs, but using a new age progression software program. So both Strauss and Sugarman looked some 20 years older, in their early 40s, as they would have at the time of the art heist. Ian Cornwell looks at the images. Then he looks up at me.
Are you kidding?
What?
That's Rye Strauss and Arlo Sugarman, he says. You think they,
do you? Ian Cornwell looks back down and seems to be studying the photographs with renewed vigor. I watch him closely. I need to gauge a reaction, and despite what you may read, no man is an open book. Still, I see something going on behind the eyes, or at least I imagine that I do.
Hold on a second, he says.
He reaches into a cabinet near the bookshelf and pulls out a black Sharpie pen. He gestures toward the photographs.
Do you mind?
Be my guest. He carefully draws mustaches on the male faces. When he's satisfied, he straightens up and then tilts his head as though he is an artist studying his handiwork. I don't look at the photographs. I keep my focus on his face. I don't like what I see.
I couldn't swear one way or the other, he pronounces after he's taken some more time. But it is certainly possible.
I say nothing.
Is there anything else, Mr. Lockwood?
Just the statute of limitations, I say.
Pardon?
It's up.
I don't understand.
So, if you had something to do with the robbery, you couldn't be prosecuted. If you, for example, gave the thieves some inside information, if you were an accessory of some sort, it's been over 20 years. The statute of limitations for this type of offense in Pennsylvania is only 5 years. In short,
You're in the clear, Professor Cornwell.
He frowns.
Clear for what?
For the Lincoln assassination, I say.
What?
I shake my head. Now do you see my issue with you?
What are you talking?
You just said clear for what, when it is so obvious that I am referring to the art heist. I mimic him and repeat, clear for what? It's overkill, Ian. It's suspicious behavior. Come to think of it, everything about your testimony is suspicious.
I don't know what you're talking about,
for example. The two robbers disguised as police officers.
What about them?
That's precisely what happened in Boston during the Gardner Museum heist. Two men, same heights you describe, same build, same fake mustaches, same claim of needing to investigate a disturbance.
You find that odd?
He counters. I do, yes.
But the FBI believed that it was the same M.O.
M.O.?
Method of operation.
Yes, I'm aware what the term means, thank you.
Well, that's why there are similarities, Mr. Lockwood. The theory is that the robberies were done by the same team.
Or, I say, that someone, perhaps you, wanted us to believe that. And a disturbance? Really? Late at night in that closed building across the green? You were working there. Did you hear a disturbance?
Well, no.
No, I repeat. Did you report one also? No. Yet you just unlocked the door to these two men with fake mustaches. Don't you think that's odd?
I thought they were police officers.
Did they have a police car?
Not that I saw.
And that's another thing. There was working CCTV on the campus entrance and exits, yet no one saw two men dressed as police officers that night.
This is a lie.
The campus didn't have that kind of surveillance back then, but it's a lie that draws blood.
I've had enough, Ian Cornwell snaps, rising to his feet. I don't care who you are.
Shh, excuse me.
Did you just...
I stare him down. If you want to change someone's behavior, remember this and this only. Human beings always do what is in their self-interest. Always. That's the sole motivator. People only do the right thing when it suits those interests. Yes, that is cynical, but it is also true.
If you want to change minds, the secret is not being thoughtful or respectful or conciliatory or presenting cogent, indisputable facts to show that said mind is wrong. And for those truly in the naive camp, the secret is not trying to appeal to our better angels or humanity. None of that works. The only way to change someone's opinion is to make them believe that siding with you is in their best interest. Period. The end.
I know what you're thinking.
I'm too lovely a creature to be this cynical, but stay with me on this. Here is my proposal, I say to Professor Cornwell. You tell me the truth about what happened that night.
I have told.
I put my index finger to my lips.
Listen
and save yourself. You tell me the truth, the full truth, just me. In return, I promise that it never leaves this room. I will tell no one, not a soul. There will be no repercussions. I don't care whether the Picasso is hanging above your toilet or if you burned it for kindling. I don't care if you were the mastermind or a pawn. Do you see what I'm offering you, Professor? The beauty of it? The chance at freedom? You simply tell me the truth, and suddenly the burden is gone. Not only that, but you have an ally for life, a grateful, powerful ally, an ally who can get you promoted or fund whatever academic, and I mean that word in two ways, dream project you have set your heart upon. Carrot done. Now, it's stick time.
I lower my voice, so he has to strain to hear.
Strain, he does.
But if you choose not to accept my generous offer, I begin to dig into your life.
Really dig.
You probably feel confident. After all, the FBI turned up nothing 24 years ago. You feel secure in your lie. But that security is now an illusion. The Vermeer is back. There is at least one dead body connected to it. The FBI will revisit the theft now with vigor, yes, but more important to your world, I will do what law enforcement cannot. I will build upon what they do, and, using my resources, I will raise that intensity, aimed in your direction, to the 10th power. Do you understand? He says nothing. Time to toss the lifeline. This is your chance, Professor Cornwell. Your chance to end the turmoil and deceptions that have haunted you for over 20 years. This is your chance to unburden yourself. This is your chance, Professor. And if you don't take it, I pity you and all those Cornwells who have come before and after you. I don't bow as I finish, though I feel perhaps that I should. As I wait for his reply, as I gaze out the window and onto the green where my father, grandfather, great-grandfather all roamed as young men, a curious thought enters my brain, distracting me, pulling me out of this moment. I'm thinking about Uncle Aldrich bucking family tradition by not coming here. Why am I thinking about that? I don't know, but it's niggling at me. I hear a chime and turn toward the sound. There is a grandfather clock in the far corner signaling the quarter hour. The door to the office bursts open, and students flow in with backpacks and expected post-lunch cacophony. Ian Cornwell says to me, "You're wrong about me. There is nothing." He shakes off the stunned look and gives the entering students a beatific smile. I can see that he is at home here. I can see that he is happy and that he is a beloved teacher. I can see that he is good at his job. But mostly, I can see that he is lying to me. Chapter 17. My father is asleep when I get back to Lockwood. I debate waking him. I need to ask him about his visiting his brother the night before Aldrich's murder, but Nigel Duncan warns me that he is medicated and will be unresponsive. So be it. Perhaps it is best if I learn more before I confront my father. I am also now on a tight schedule. The branch manager at the Bank of Manhattan has agreed to see me in 90 minutes. Nigel walks me to the helicopter. "What are you trying to find?" he asks me. Should I dramatically pause, spin toward you, and then exclaim, "The truth, damn it?" Nigel shakes his head. "You're a funny guy, Wynne." The helicopter gets me back to Chelsea in time. As Magda drives me toward the Upper West Side branch of the bank, I pick up the tail. It's a black Lincoln Town Car. The same car had been following me this morning. Amateurs. I'm almost insulted that they aren't trying harder. "Small change of plans," I tell Magda. "Oh? Kindly swing by the office on Park Avenue before we head up to the bank." "You're the boss." I am indeed. My next step isn't complicated. The crosstown traffic is mercifully light. When we arrive at the Lockhorn building, Magda moves my car to my usual drop-off point. She puts the car in park. "Don't get out," I say. I use the camera function on my iPhone to watch behind me. The black Lincoln Town Car is three cars back, double parked. Such amateurs. I wait. This won't take long. I see Kabir sneaking up behind the Lincoln. He stops behind it and bends down as though to tie his shoe. He's not. He's placing a magnetic GPS under the bumper. Like I said, this isn't complicated. Kabir rises, nods to let me know the tracker is secure on the Lincoln's bumper, and heads back the other way. Okay, I tell Magda. We can proceed. I call Kabir as we head uptown. He will keep an eye on the car. I'll also run the license plate, he tells me. I thank him and hang up. As we approach the bank, I add up the pros and cons of losing the tail. It wouldn't be difficult. And decide that I would rather not tip them off. Let them see me go into the branch of a bank on the Upper West Side. So what? 5 minutes later, I'm in a glass-enclosed office that looks out over the main floor. The bank itself is a lovely old building on Broadway and 74th Street. Way back when, this very structure was, well, a bank, from the days when banks were cathedral-like and awe-inspiring, as opposed to today's storefronts that have all the warmth of a motel chain lobby. The branch still had the marble columns, the chandeliers, the oak wood teller stations, the giant round safe door. It was one of the few of said buildings that hadn't been converted into a party space or upscale dining facility. The bank manager's name, which is on her desk plate, is Jill Garrity. Her hair is pulled back into a bun so tight, I worry her scalp might bleed. She wears horn-rimmed glasses. The collar of her white blouse is stiff enough to take out an eye. It's wonderful to meet you, Mr. Lockwood. We do a lot of business with the bank. She hopes that my visit means more. I don't dissuade her of this notion, but time is a-wasting. I tell her I need a favor. She leans in, anxious to please. I ask her about the bank robbery. There isn't much to tell, she says. Was it a stick-up? Was it armed? Oh, no, no. It was after hours. They broke in at 2 in the morning. This surprises me. How? She starts fiddling with the ring on her hand. I don't mean to be rude. Then don't be. She startles up at my interruption. I hold her gaze. Tell me about the robbery. It takes a second or two, but we both know where this will go. One of our guards was in on it. His record was clean. We did a thorough background check, but his sister's husband was somehow involved with the mob. I really don't know the details. How much money did they take? Very little, Jill Garrity says a little too defensively. As you are probably aware, most branches don't keep that much cash on hand. If your worry, Mr. Lockwood, involves stolen cash, none of our clients were affected in terms of their financial portfolios. I had figured this. What I couldn't figure out was why Rye Strauss would have been upset by the robbery. It could have been his paranoia, his imagination, but it feels as though it had to be something more. And why does Ms. Garrity still look as though she's hiding something? Financial portfolios, I repeat. Pardon? You said your clients weren't affected in terms of financial portfolios. She twists the ring some more. So how were they affected? She leans back. I assume the robbers came for cash. I mean, that makes the most sense. But when they saw that wasn't going to happen, they went for the next best thing. That being, this is an old building, so downstairs in the basement, we still have safe deposit boxes. I can almost hear something in my brain go click. They broke into them? Yes. All, many, or a select few? Almost all. So, not specifically targeted. Have you notified your clients? It's complicated. We are doing our best. Do you know much about safe deposit boxes? I know that I would never use one, I say. She pulls back at first, but then she settles into a nod. We don't have them in newer branches, truthfully. They are a headache, expensive to build and maintain, small profit margin, they take up too much space, and there are often problems. What kind of problems? People store their valuables, jewelry, paperwork, birth certificates, contracts, passports, deeds, coin or stamp collections, but sometimes, well, they forget. They'll come in, they'll open their box, and suddenly they'll start yelling that a valuable diamond necklace is missing. Usually they just forgot they took it out. Sometimes it's outright fraud. Claim something was stolen that they never put in the box in the first place?
Exactly.
And sometimes, rarely, we mess up, and it's our fault. Very rarely.
How would you mess up?
If a client stops paying for their box, we have to evict them. We give many warnings, of course, but if they don't pay, we drill open the box and send the contents to our main branch downtown. One time, we drilled the wrong box. The man came in, opened his box, and all his belongings were gone.
It is starting to make sense. And when you have a real break-in like this?
You can imagine, she says.
And I can.
Suddenly, every client is claiming they had expensive Rolex watches in their boxes or rare stamps worth $500,000. Clients never read the fine print, of course, but the bank's liability for any loss for any reason shall not exceed 10 times the cost of the annual rent for the box.
How much do you charge to rent?
It's rarely more than a few $100s a year.
Not very much, I think. So now you're reaching out to clients, I continue. Many are claiming that they lost way in excess of what you are legally obligated to pay out, correct?
Correct.
But, alas, I think I may be putting this together. Yes, people store valuables, as she's described, but they store more than that. They store secrets.
What's your largest sized box?
In this branch, 8 by 8 inches with a 2-foot depth.
No way to hide the Picasso here, then. Though I didn't think Strauss would. That wasn't the point of the box. That wasn't the reason for his panic. I take out a photo still frame from the Beresford surveillance video, the clearest shot I have of pre-murdered Rye Strauss.
Do you recognize this man?
She studies the photograph.
I don't think so. I mean, it's hard to make out much.
The clients you notified about the safe deposit boxes, I begin.
What about them?
How did you reach them?
By certified mail.
Did you call any on the phone?
I don't think so. That wouldn't be us, anyway. We have an insurance branch in Delaware that handles that.
So there is no chance someone from this branch would have called a client and invited them to come down here to discuss the theft?
None whatsoever.
I ask a few more questions, but for the first time since this mess began, I feel as though I have some clarity. As I exit, my phone rings. I'm rather surprised to see it's Jessica.
You busy? She asks.
Shouldn't we work our next rendezvous through the app?
You blew your chance.
You wouldn't have gone through with it, I say.
Guess we'll never know. But I'm not calling about that. Do you know they just announced Rye Strauss's identity?
I knew they were going to, yes.
Well, I was ready for it. I pitched the New Yorker a follow-up story on the whole Jane Street 6, update my previous Where Are They Now piece.
I assume they bought the pitch?
I can be charming when I want to be.
Oh, I'm sure.
So, anyway, I'm going right now to interview Vanessa Hogan, the victim's mother who is the last person to see Billy Rowan. Want to come?
Jessica says, I can't believe Windsor Horn Lockwood III is taking the subway. I hold on to the bar overhead. We are on the A train heading south. I'm a man of the people, I tell her.
You are anything but a man of the people.
I'll have you know that I recently flew commercial.
Jessica frowns.
No, you didn't.
No,
I didn't, but I thought about it. The reason for the subway ride is simpler. I don't want whoever is following me to know where we are going. I had Magda make a quick turn so that the car was out of sight for a few seconds. I used those seconds to get out and vanish into the Davenport Theater lobby on 45th Street, exit out the side, head into the back entrance of the Comfort Inn Times Square West, and then I reappeared on 44th Street. I headed east toward 8th Avenue and met up with Jessica by the subway entrance on 42nd Street. You can figure out the rest of my plan, methinks. Most likely, the Black Lincoln Town Car.
Could you choose a more obvious vehicle?
is tailing Magda through the Lincoln Tunnel into New Jersey, whilst Jessica and I take the A train to Queens, where another car driver will whisk us to the home of Vanessa Hogan.